This episode is brought to you by Awesome CX by Transcom. Awesome CX provides high-touch, personalized customer experience services to consumer brands of any size. Stay tuned for a special offer for Stairway to CEO listeners later in the show. Hello, everyone. It's Lee Green, and welcome back to the Stairway to CEO podcast. It's my mission to bring you real, honest, and unfiltered interviews with some of the most innovative founders and CEOs from all walks of life. We'll talk about their climb to the top, their stumbles along the way, and the steps they took to get them to where they are. So tune in to get inspired, listen to some real talk, and enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Lee Green, and welcome back to the Stairway to CEO podcast. This is episode 195, and today I sat down with Hudson David Ross, the co-founder and CEO of Plant People. Starting with mushroom gummies, Plant People creates doctor-formulated, regenerative, organic plant and mushroom supplements with the mission to provide safe, natural alternatives to pharmaceuticals. In this episode, Hudson shares his story from growing up in Brooklyn to working on the founding team of Aloha to building Rise Brewing, a nitro cold brew coffee company, to getting spinal surgery and having to learn how to walk again, which inspired him to start Plant People. He talks about his struggles with ADHD, how the company lost 90% of its revenue when COVID hit, and his advice for getting into major retailers like Whole Foods. I hope you enjoyed this episode and thanks so much for listening. Hi, Hudson. How are you? Thanks so much for joining me on the show this morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm excited to hear more about Plant People and your journey in building this company. I know it's not your first rodeo, so I'm excited to hear more about it. Let's start from the very beginning. Where did you grow up? Where are you from originally?
Yeah, so I'm from Brooklyn, New York, born and raised New Yorker over here, now living in Texas, in Austin. Yeah, I'm 37. And yeah, spent most of my life
going straight to the age.
Yeah, 37. And
you're the first person who's done that. No one talks about their age.
Well, I feel like I'm like 70 at this point. So I'm always in bed by 9:30, 10. So
37 going on 70.
Yeah.
As all the 45-year-olds and 50-year-olds are like, F you, what are you talking about?
I know.
You're not old. So you grew up in Brooklyn. Talk to me about what it was like growing up there in New York and what kind of kid were you?
Yeah. So, I mean, growing up in New York is definitely, it's a madhouse. I feel like I learned a lot very quickly. So many cultures there, so many people. You just get a lot of stimulation of a lot of different experiences from a very young age. And, you know, it really is the epicenter of every sort of industry hobby. You know, there's art, there's finance, there's marketing, there's food and beverage. I mean, it really is the epicenter of so many industries. So I'm really great for it. I think it's definitely, at certain ages, it feels like it can make or break you, but I'm really grateful for the experience. And, you know, like I was taking the subway to school starting in eighth grade by myself. So it was definitely a wonderful experience of meeting so many things and experiencing so many different things at the same time.
And having to be probably pretty independent early on, right?
Definitely. Definitely.
What kind of, did you have siblings growing up? What did your parents do? Like, kind of paint the picture for us about what it was like.
Yeah. So I have two siblings, two older sisters. I'm the baby boy of the family. So the household was definitely female dominated, and which is great. I feel like I am reaping the benefits of that now being married, of really, hopefully, I like to say that I can understand women, but it's always hit or miss, it feels. But yeah, my parents definitely through and through New Yorkers. I'm actually a fifth generation New Yorker. So my family's been in New York City for quite a long time. My father is a real estate lawyer now going on retiring. And then my mother really climbed the ranks from starting off with magazines when magazines were super cool and trendy. So like Time Magazine, Fortune Magazine, really that heyday where instead of social media, there were magazines and that's where all the advertising went. And so she was an executive there. And then she headed towards communications and PR, but mostly sort of like the more corporate communications field. and really became a leader in CEO reputation, which is really cool. And at the time, people didn't really talk about CEOs and they were behind the scenes just making a lot of money. And then with the rise of social media, employees and also customers were given a weapon to respond and sort of like call out CEOs. So she really focused on that in her last like decade of her career and was a C-level executive at the largest communications firm called Weber Shandwick. So I always like to say if I ever got in trouble, I had someone in communications and then I had a lawyer. It was always great to have them behind me.
When you were a kid, looking back, I guess, what kind of things were you into? Were you into sports? Like, what did you love doing? And also, did you have anything like entrepreneurial that stuck out or leadership things that stuck out?
Yeah, so I was definitely active. I have ADHD, so was definitely into sports. I was playing ice hockey. Most of my life, I traveled up and down the East Coast, playing travel, AA, AAA hockey. And it was my life. So I was doing roller hockey in Brooklyn. So there was a league near me and we'd play once or twice a week there. And then the rest of the days I was basically playing on a travel ice hockey team. As a kid, obviously into video games, was also had some other creative hobbies. I would say it wasn't until high school where I became a little bit more of like a more formal multitasker. So I was like editor of the paper. I was taking cooking lessons. I was doing hockey. I was taking two languages. I was kind of like really going for pushing life to the next level. And it's amazing how much energy I had then. So.
And when did you realize you had ADHD? Did you realize that in high school or did that come later?
It was kind of a better for worse situation. So in eighth grade, this is my story. My parents say this isn't true, but from my understanding, the head of middle school was like, we can't continue on to high school unless your son gets checked for ADHD. That's basically what my high level understanding is. Although my parents say that's not actually what happened, but that's the story I've been saying for some time. And I got diagnosed. I went and they were like, you have ADHD. And I was put on Adderall at a very early age. I think I have a love and hate relationship with Adderall. And actually, I always hope to, at some point in my life, write a book on having ADHD and being an entrepreneur, because I think there's a lot of plus and minuses, mostly pluses. You know, with ADHD, I think it's a blessing. Whereas when I was diagnosed, I thought it was actually a deficit and a negative. Because you're in this system where everyone is sort of ranked the same way. I actually went to a school that didn't have grades, but most kids, almost all kids, are in a system where there are grades. And if you can't pay attention, then you're not going to hit the grades. And so you're forced to get diagnosed or suggested to get diagnosed. And then you get diagnosed and then you get on Adderall, which, or any sort of drug like that for attention. And you really do conform to sort of like that structure and that system. And I think the negative is you sort of lose your personality and creativity. And an example is I couldn't really write papers anymore, but I was killing it in math. I was organized. I was showing up every day and I was doing multiple hobbies and extracurriculars. So I became like a machine, but I wasn't able to tap into sort of my creative mindset. And my personality definitely changed. But I think the biggest winning was that I realized that I could participate and I had it in me to do those things. And so when I ended up stop taking that medicine senior year of high school, I actually kind of could participate, be organized, realize what my potential was, but also tap back into the creativity that was, you know, missed so much when I was on that medicine.
Yeah. And so after high school, what did you want to be, I guess, when you grew up, when you were a kid? And what kind of path did you set yourself on after high school?
Yeah. So after high school, I did a couple of internships that summer after high school. And then the internships there afterwards, I was grateful enough to get internships at adjacent companies to where my mother was working. Through those sort of connections, I was able, I don't know if that's why I got in, but it was definitely introductions to internship programs at marketing agencies. I quickly realized that the agency life wasn't for me because most agencies, especially at that time, were agencies weren't sort of like saying, we're not going to work with a cigarette company or we're not going to work with like a pharmaceutical company for these like sort of moral issue concerns. At the time I was interning, they were just working with everyone. And I felt like I was just not interested in all the businesses. But I got a really good sense of how marketing works at an early age, as well as also really started to see the transition traditional advertising, magazines and newspapers to really the digital world.
Okay. And so you kind of realized agencies aren't for you. And I know that you worked at Gilt Group. So talk to us about, you know, I guess how your experience was at Gilt Group. That was a pretty awesome company. I think probably when you were there too.
Yeah. So I would say just like to take a step back, when I was in college, I studied Chinese and was an East Asian studies concentration. That's what you call it at Brown. I went to Brown. And towards the end, I actually had taken Chinese in middle school and high school. And so I actually had completed a lot of the prerequisites to complete that concentration. So the latter half of Brown, I actually really focused on entrepreneurial courses, where many of the courses were studying HBS cases. So how businesses were started, what their problems were and how they solved them, and also having debates within the organization, I mean, within classes to how we would solve the problems, or what did we learn from these founders starting these businesses and how they solve problems. And so that's where I really jumped into the entrepreneurial track. I graduated in 2009 from Brown, and it was that month was like the pinnacle of the financial crisis. So there were 800,000 job cuts. All the previous classes at Brown all went into finance, not all of them, but a lot of people went into finance and consulting. All those companies came to recruit on our campus, and that wasn't happening at that month. And so I was like, okay, what am I going to do? And I ended up interviewing Google and a few other startups, and I actually ended up getting a job offer at Google. But I was like, I feel like I'm going to be a small fish in Silicon Valley, and I really want to be able to get more responsibility. And I started going on actually TechCrunch, and I started looking for New York City companies that were like raising money and stuff like that. And at the time, there really weren't many startups in New York City. Now there's Silicon Alley, or that's what it was like called for one period, which is around 18th Street in the Flatiron. And Gilt Group popped up, and I saw that they were doing something really cool in e-commerce, physical product. I wanted to stay in New York City, near family and friends. And it was really like Gilt Group and Foursquare. I'm sure you remember Foursquare. And those were like the two cool companies at the time. And there weren't many other startups. So what I ended up doing was I applied. And then I was like, they're so small. So I called their customer support. And I was like, yo, I applied to a job. Can you? And so I hustled basically and really annoyed them. And then the recruiting company, I mean, the in-house recruiter ended up reaching out to me. So I joined very early on, where there were tens of employees. And when I left, I think it was close to 3,000. So I really saw a company with funding, but also performing really well, really grow from like zero to 100, essentially. And they were launching multiple verticals. And I will say, like, I got my e-commerce director consumer chops there at that time. I mean, there was Shopify, but people were really building custom websites, and also email marketing was pretty custom. So Gilt Group created the abandoned cart email. That's how early it was in e-commerce. That's pretty crazy. And now it's used all the time. And so I was able to really see e-commerce from ground zero, and also how to work with many cross-functional departments. And I also didn't know any better. It was my first job. I was going through a breakup, became my life. I was there super early in the morning, all the way till late at night. And so they gave me a lot of responsibility because I was a workhorse and I was really organized. And so I ended up launching, especially from an operational standpoint and a little bit of like a project manager standpoint, their home business, international, and then like their food and wine. So they were doing food and beverage at some point.
And then after that, after working at Gilt Group, I think you started, or no, you're on the founding team of Aloha. What made you want to switch, I guess, and get out of Gilt Group into something else?
Yeah, I would say like, you know, I was at Gilt for 3 years. It felt started to get really big and sort of like clunky. I just also started to really strive for something that felt new again. I was really good at launching things and wanted to do something with a little bit more ownership again. The business Gilt was amazing, really incredible people that they were hired. And many Gilt alumni have started so many companies, but I was just looking for something new. And so a partner at Thrive Capital, who I was speaking to, basically introduced me to the main founder of Aloha. And I was really into health and wellness, and I always have been. And I thought there was a huge opportunity to build a branded e-commerce player in the supplements business. And this was at a time where there weren't so many supplement businesses and there really weren't many plant-based supplements. A lot of it was like whey protein and just traditional capsules. And we really wanted to build like a lifestyle brand in the supplement space. And I thought that was really intriguing. The main founder, Constantine, is definitely a vision builder. He's a vision guy. I was brought in to be sort of the operational COO type. And I oversaw pretty much a majority of the teams. And then I left around, I'd say, 2.5 years in.
All right. Nice. And so is there anything, I guess, because that's kind of, I guess that's the second startup you worked for essentially, right? So here you're kind of really getting a lot of startup experience. What are some of the takeaways, I guess, from Aloha that you, even if it's like things not to do, because I think there's a lot of learnings from that as well, especially when you're working with an early stage team.
Yeah. So I would say like Aloha was my first, you know, Constantine was the main founder, but I do really feel like I started the business. Like when I came in, they were thinking about being like the sports authority online. And I was really pushing against that. I was like, it was at the time when brands were like just being created on direct to consumer. And, you know, there was like Warby Parker and it was like a brand. You know, usually you went to brand stores and then like you went to sort of like general retail stores and you could see their general retail stores like Saks, Bloomingdale's and Sports Authority. Those types of retail stores were sort of like older and people really wanted to have affinity towards a brand. And I remember I put together this presentation to be like, no, we need to be a brand. We need fewer products, not sell everyone else's products. We'll have more margin, more control. And let's like create a lifestyle brand. I remember that really well. That was like my first week sort of like joining the team. And I think at the time there was only like 3 other people there. And I think the learnings was I could really build a business and really do it from the brand side all the way through supply chain. And I was responsible for pretty much all of that. And I think the learning there is if you have a really big vision, Constantine was an amazing fundraiser. If you have a really big vision and momentum with other investors, people will invest. It really is a hype game. And so I learned a lot around fundraising. That was like probably predominantly like my biggest learning. I would say like the don'ts on that business was, I think there was a lack of focus for the company and it created a lot of stress systemically through the business. And I spent a lot of my time protecting, I felt like my teams and also the business and just sort of focus around the business to make it scalable. Because I was overseeing supply chain and also recruiting. I was hiring everyone. And, you know, if you're changing your sort of like goalposts every 2 to 3 months, yes, that's like startup vibes. But when they're really huge sort of shifts and you're trying to do it all, like you'll lose focus and you'll also create too much liability financially for the business.
And so at what point did you realize or decide for yourself that you wanted to start your own company? Because here you were kind of working on founding teams and in small, you know, startups, but then you went off to start Crosby, Rise Brewing, and then Plant People. So what made you kind of shift into that?
Yeah. So I think one of the things when I left Aloha was we were trying to be like the Apple of supplements. So we created these like really complex formula products that took forever to produce, were expensive to make, and also were just high price point. And, you know, the thing about Apple, the Apple of anything, is that it takes decades. You know, you can't just do that in a matter of a year or two. But that's what we pitched a lot of the investors. And so I think there was a bit of a disconnect there. And for me, I wanted organic demand. So I was like, when I left, I went backpacking through Southeast Asia. But before I did, I was like, I want to do something that people love already, but do it better. Or what people love already and do it cheaper. And that's what I realized was like the opportunity in this space in most industries, because you don't have to convince people of this new product and why it fits in your lifestyle. It's much easier to get to market and grow a business if someone's already doing something and just do it better. So a much easier pitch and conversion. So I was thinking about like, what do I love? I love black coffee. That was one of the things I loved. And I was like, well, the issue that I have with black coffee is that when you have it day to day, back to back, it's kind of dull. And if you get this like nasty taste after a while, you want to change it up. And so while I was at Aloha, I started researching sort of innovation in the coffee space. And I met a coffee producer who basically was like, hey, you know, one thing that you could do that I saw someone do the other day was you can infuse coffee with nitrogen, kind of like a Guinness. And I was like, wow, that sounds amazing. And so I ended up working with this guy to make a little mini keg, which is a little keg. And you basically infuse it with nitrogen. You put cold brew in, you infuse it with nitrogen. And basically it tasted just like a really frothy and creamy cold brew. And that was amazing for me personally, because I was like, this is not dull. This is something I can have on a daily basis, or I could have it every other day just to change it up. I was always jealous of all my friends who had dairy or sugar in their products, because they would go and they would have a latte or a cappuccino, and I was always just getting black coffee. So for me,
are you allergic or something? Or
no, I just stayed away from like adding things, honestly. Like I like to keep things clean. And so for me to just infuse it with nitrogen, which is totally safe to have, you know, it's not an additive in the fact that it's like adding ingredients or sugar or some sort of other. Yeah. It just makes it more of an experiential black coffee in a way. So what I ended up doing, I was like, dude, this is amazing. And so I ended up making around 250 cans and had all these blank cans in my fridge. I paid this guy to make them. I'm actually really grateful for him for doing that, because he actually, it's so funny, he was like at a company and really interested in supporting. He didn't end up like joining Rise eventually, but he definitely helped me get to where I needed to be. And then I gave it to friends and family, and there were people who were like, this is amazing. And I also wanted to litmus test it. So I went outside of a Whole Foods and started opening up cans and like also seeing if people would buy it for a dollar, just getting feedback. And I got to tell you something, my biggest learning from that is I learned more in 6 hours of standing outside of Whole Foods, which by the way, is probably not legal, than 6 months talking to people about this business. I learned what people like about name, flavor, consistency, would they buy this, et cetera. And so that was a really sort of like life-changing moment that I just had to get to market.
So wait, you were passing out cans that were blank, like just white cans, like mystery juice, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like silver cans.
I would be like, no.
Yeah, so non-printed. You'd be surprised. Like people are down. And also
to try something from a stranger. You're like, hey, you want to try this? Were you set up? Did you have like anything around like there's coffee in this mystery can?
I kid you not. I wish I had a photo, but I had a table and I had literally just silver cans lined up and I had a cooler. And I basically was just like handing it out. And that's basically it. And it was there for 6 hours. A lot of people said no. One of the learnings, which was interesting, probably the biggest learning was a lot of people said they were scared of the word nitro. If you think about it, right. It kind of makes sense, like nitro for sure. In a beverage. But now people kind of get it. That was like a really big educational point for customers in the beginning of Rise. So I went from there to building out a deck, basically getting investors lined up, had a brand originally. And then I met some guys along the way who were working on it in keg form. It's actually kind of a funny story. I was going through another breakup and I wasn't doing so great. And a mutual friend of ours, Mike, basically was like, hey, what are you up to? And I told him I was like upset. And then he basically brought me to New York City Ranger game. And I went to the Ranger game and he was like, what are you up to? I was like, oh, I'm working on these nitro coffee cans. He was like, that's so funny. My friends from home are working on it in keg form. I was like, oh, I've always wanted to do kegs. And he's like, oh, well, they always want to do cans. But I had access to the special can, which no one had access to. Obviously, I had made a lot of headway. I met them and we basically started to work together. And, you know, to be a solo founder is very difficult. You kind of go crazy. And so we were off to the races from there. So, you know, I'm grateful for those partners. They're currently running the business. I stepped away around 4 years ago to focus on Plant People. But that's the story of Rise. And, you know, it's in a lot of supermarkets, really proud of the business, proud of that team. And I'm also really grateful that I had the experience of like starting the business and being there from day zero. And I was there for 5 years. So I haven't been there obviously in a few years and I left the board around 2 years ago, but yeah, I'm excited to see where that business goes and the product is great.
And now we're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Customer service and call centers are rarely topics that people get excited about, but Awesome CX is simply different. Their inclusive culture rooted in wellness and fun means that their teams are encouraged to be their best selves personally and professionally by providing them with everything from mental health and healthcare resources to career development. And regardless of the size of your business, AwesomeCX is uniquely positioned to support you throughout your growth. They work with some of the fastest growing startups like FabFitFun, Carbon 38, Lettuce Grow, Mudwater, and so many more. Want to see it to believe it? Just email me directly at lee@stairwaytoceo.com to request to join one of their coffee chats where you can meet with their amazing team and witness the agent engagement yourself. You'll be so impressed. I can't wait for you to learn more about AwesomeCX to make your brand's customer experience awesome. Thank you so much to our incredible sponsors for supporting the Stairway to CEO podcast. Now let's get back to the show. And so at what point were you, how did you know it was time to step away? And how did you come up with the idea for Plant People?
Yeah, so actually when I was starting Rise, I put my personal savings in, so I needed money. And I basically started doing fundraising decks for people. And when I did fundraising decks for people, they would raise money. And then they were like, hey, can you help with branding and packaging? And that's how Crosby, my branding and business strategy firm, started. So when I was starting Rise, I also had an agency. And they both grew pretty quickly. And so I was basically running point on a lot of, on two different organizations. And so when I decided, basically a few months after, I was like, I want to focus on Plant People, that I would step away from Rise, but also Crosby. I was really good at multitasking, similar to what I was explaining in high school. And I was really like, I felt like I was like optimal performance for my brain and just like for entrepreneurial life. But one thing I've learned is like, you can bring businesses to a couple $100,000 or a few million, but you can't bring it to $10 million to $100 million business if you're not all in. And you really need to be all in and focused. And when I looked at Rise, you know, I was like, definitely I had a bunch of other like now co-founders. At the time, I had the majority stake in the business. I gave back a few points to hire like someone in replacement of me. And I'm very grateful for having done that because she was a powerhouse for the business and still is. She's still there. And then I looked at Crosby and I was like, man, the services industry is just tough. Like you're constantly like pitching people you like honestly like don't want to work with probably if you were full-time there. And it's all about cash flow. And like people are just upset. They text you on the weekends and people, you know, it's just they get bad clients, good clients. And when I looked at Plant People, I was like, high margin supplements, higher price points, like D2C friendly. It's not heavy like beverage. And just like the economics, like it made more sense, that type of business. And that was like the business side. But heading towards Plant People, like the main reason I started this business is I had spinal surgery, learned how to walk again.
Why did you need spinal surgery?
Yeah, so I had a tumor in my spinal canal, which is crazy. I didn't even know I had a, I didn't even know there was a canal. And I had to basically have this crazy surgery and then I had to learn how to walk again. And I didn't want to take pharmaceuticals because I felt like at the time they were addictive. They were also like chemicals and made me feel weird. And so I started exploring mushrooms, cannabis. And my now co-founder, Gabe, who also had a spinal surgery and was exploring plant-based modalities himself. And so we started together. And I just was more, I had more passion for making an impact in people's lives. When we started playing around with our initial formulas at Plant People, we loved it. We started giving to friends and family. And, you know, people were coming back saying, hey, I'm sleeping better. I have less stress. I don't have any pain in my feet or my knees. And that just was so rewarding. I mean, coffee is an amazing product. When you give it to someone, you're basically getting them high. Like it's euphoria, right? You get the caffeine. But when you talk about like making it people an impact in people's lives every day, with whether it's like sleep or stress or with pain relief or something along those lines, helping them with their true needs, there's nothing better than that. That's a really big like return on investment. And then again, like obviously the business economics just made a lot more sense.
So were you really out to kind of help people that were mostly struggling with stress and sleep? Is that what you were finding that mushrooms and cannabis were helping with the most?
Yeah. So that's actually how we really launched. We launched in 2018 in primarily in the CBD category. And this was, Gabe and I always talk about how we saw like the CBD wave demand out in the distance, like you're surfing. And we're on our paddleboards and we see it and we're like, okay, let's go catch that wave. That's what it felt like at the time. I think when we were at the height of it, the wave was there. And the question is like, how do we stay on top? And we really made a lot of headway. So actually in our first 18 months, Gabe and I put our personal savings in, didn't raise any external capital. And we did like a few million in 18 months, only with like four employees. Predominantly, Gabe and I were doing it ourselves the first 6 months. And we hustled. Super profitable. The CBD category really grew. And so we did as well. And we were definitely like a leader in like main market being New York City. And we were always mixing adaptogens, nootropics with CBD. We were never just doing CBD oil. We were plant people for a reason. And we had always planned on doing stuff outside of CBD as well. And predominantly the business was that type of business. It was CBD focused. And we, you know, I would say the end of that, like 18 months, end of 2019, we were like, okay, it's time to step up. So we ended up like hiring a bunch of people, and like the next stage of the business was totally different. It was a pretty wild experience.
Yeah, I mean, with the first couple months that you guys were bootstrapping, and you said you made a few million in sales in just a few months, but like, how did that happen? How are you? What was your distribution? Or did you guys just run ads? And what was the product that was selling the most?
Yeah, so we did like the basic hustle. So we were like walking into stores, literally showing people product. And like, we had so much pushback in the beginning because people didn't understand CBD. They thought it was weed. They thought it was THC. They were like, well, I get high from this. That was like the biggest education point. And I can't believe looking back at it, that that's what we were dealing with when now everyone kind of knows what it is. And we were doing dinners. Gabe's a chef. So we were doing these sort of like more experiential dinners and just like building community grassroots wise. We didn't have money to really spend marketing wise. I mean, we did, but we were just sort of like hustling and putting the profits into more products. And we were predominantly selling online, and our wholesale business was killing it. We were 50% online and offline.
And what was the product again?
So we had the predominant products were CBD capsules with adaptogens for stress. We had CBD capsules with nootropics for focus. And then we had tinctures that were like high in CBN, CBG. And to be honest, I really think that we were like the first company to just not do CBD oil, like take this, here's the milligram ounce. We were literally calling it like sleep and calling it relief. We were really like sort of like branding the products. And the reason why was sleep, we were using a higher level of CBN, which was better for sleep than say CBD, although CBD is great for sleep. So we were like kind of like the first to really start to use those cannabinoids in that way. And yeah, I mean, it was an incredible experience. We think we were 50-50 offline and online killing. We had some accounts in New York City that were doing like close to a million a year. It was amazing. We were in all these cool like restaurants doing on their menu where you could add CBD to any beverage. We just had like hit it. It was super, it was doing really well. And we were like, okay, let's like scale this up. And so we ended up raising a couple hundred thousand dollars. And a lot of the investors were like, hey, we want you to take more of our money, like a couple million. We're like, why would we do that? Like, we have millions of profit and we're doing so well with so little. Like, why dilute ourselves? But also, like, why take on that pressure and add a board seat? And so we ended up bringing the team to like 14 people. And we brought on like the nation's best, like, broker for national specialty and conventional presence marketing and all the, we were about to launch with like Kahan Unified Distributors, March 2020 at Expo West. And then COVID hit and damn, COVID was not great. We lost 90% of our revenue within like a week or two for wholesale. And then we were thrown into the gauntlet of D2C, the D2C world. So that being, you know, high spend businesses that are literally have raised money solely based on paid marketing. Many of which are no longer around today because they were unsustainable businesses. But we were like, had to, during COVID, we had to acquire customers for like $140. Now our CAC is like below 40. So that was an unfortunate period because we had to turn into like a high spend business as retail recovered, which took like, retail did not recover for like two and a half years for us. And now it's stronger than ever. And so where we're at today is, I would say that we're in a much better position. We have products that have really strong product market fit. We're selling more units than ever. We have more revenue than ever. We're profitable again, like we were pre-COVID. I put together an 18-month plan, I'd say like at the beginning of 2022, and we executed on that. We moved our warehouse from New York City to Austin. We basically didn't rehire for those employees that eventually ended up leaving. They were all at the company for 3 years. That's a great run for a startup, if you ask me. And we optimized and dialed in our spend. And it's just been killer since. And I'm just so happy to be past the COVID experience. We have major retailers with Whole Foods, Vitamin Shop, Erewhon, Sprouts just launched. We're at DoorDash. Just some really great retailers. And then our D2C and Amazon is just growing very quickly and very profitable. And so we're definitely on the other side of that experience and the business is resilient.
That's great. Yeah, COVID has, I think there's many stories, especially on this show, from founders that have had some serious challenges when COVID hit. Talk to us about, I guess, what advice do you have for founders that are building a brand that want to be selling in these same retailers, like Whole Foods, Erewhon? I mean, these are really awesome retailers. So how did you, you know, get in? What advice do you have for, you know, trying to sell into retail?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you now, the last three businesses I started, it took three to upwards of 4 years to get into Whole Foods. I would say you just got to hustle. You have to have a product that they're looking for or one that is innovative and they're not looking for, but makes sense. So for example, our current top performing products are these mushroom gummies. Customers are interested in mushrooms. We all know that, adaptogens, functional mushrooms, but we are the first in the market to really offer gummy forms in many different solution focused SKUs. And so I think like really trying to tap into, as I mentioned with Rise, like tap into what customers want or already doing, but doing it better. Or having a product that like people really want inherently. I think, you know, Whole Foods and Erewhon, they're tapped into what people are looking for and they get a lot of data around that. You just need to have like an edge or a cool brand. But I would just say in general, you just got to hustle. You have to go with momentum. You have to have a lot of boutiques, a lot of independents. And when you have that momentum, then you can get the attention of distributors because distributors want your momentum and they want your volume because it's a volume game. And then when you want to work with like a Whole Foods, you have to have relationship with a distributor. So what happens a lot of the time is you can't really get into those stores, the large retailers, unless you have a distributor as well. So it's kind of like this weird triangle deal with most brands is like, say Whole Foods is interested, they will be like, you need to work with Unify. So you basically have to bring Unify and Whole Foods online at the same time. And that's usually for working with a distributor, like you need like an anchor account, like a Whole Foods or Sprouts or something to work with a distributor. Your business won't work otherwise. You need volume.
Interesting. And how do you feel like, what's some advice you have for people that are like, I want to go into retail. How do I meet all these buyers, right? Like some of them are on LinkedIn, some of them kind of not. It's kind of hard to find. They're all called different titles. You know, what's some advice you have, I guess, for finding the right people at retailers to talk to?
Honestly, you just need to be persistent and you need the hustle. I will tell you now, I've sent over probably 5,000 cold outreach emails or just call places. You got to do it all. That there is no secret sauce. The secret sauce is to be an entrepreneur. The definition of an entrepreneur is to use the resources you don't have to achieve what you believe in. And so what I did is I walked in the stores. I hustled. I asked for the manager. That's what I did. Not like the major retailers, but like indies and boutiques. And they usually have higher margins. So you kind of want those sort of like that velocity for those accounts. LinkedIn. Sign up for a LinkedIn premium. Send those emails, whatever you want to call them. Three, find out who they're mutually connected to. Ask for an introduction. The number of people who I've probably annoyed in my life just to get an introduction, I haven't actually been doing that in a long time because I have people you really do use LinkedIn now. So I do a lot of like cold outreach. It also gets easier when you have a product that people actually want to carry. Introductions, I think also calling. So like there's a lot of like stores where I'll just call. So like a 17 door chain, I'll call one of them, be like, who do I speak to? They'll be like, oh, here's the person from corporate. You just got to hustle. One of the other things is like, if you have the money is like buying a ticket to Expo West, but like you kind of have to run into those buyers.
It's hard, a lot of people there. There's like thousands of people.
If you're a no-name brand, it's kind of also hard. You can have a booth and maybe people will come by and you can get those. But I find Expo West, like there isn't much conversion actually. And we haven't done Expo West the last 2 years because of that. Like it's just an expensive thing. And like we're actually losing a lot of money having me and my co-founder out and not at our desk, I think, especially if we have a lot of demand already. So I would say like my two cents is like, you just got to give it your all. One benefit is if you have the capital, you can hire sales managers who have been in sales and they have Rolodexes. And that does help. But I think no one sells better than the founder or the CEO. Yeah,
absolutely. Before we wrap up here, what's some, you know, final advice you have for entrepreneurs that are thinking about diving in and starting their own company, or even founders that are in the trenches right now? What's some kind of like final advice you have? And then what's coming up next for Plant People?
Yeah. So I've done a few sort of talks or speaking engagements around this. And I think like it depends on what stage the founder's in or the entrepreneur's in. But the first thing I always say is like, you have to get to market. And as mentioned with Rise, like you'll learn more just getting into market or getting into stores, literally walking into stores, be like, will you carry this product? They'll explain why they won't carry it. It's too expensive. My consumers think it's too expensive. People aren't looking for sugary drinks. People like aren't looking for, you know, tinctures of mushrooms or something like that. Like you'll just learn a lot by hitting the streets. So I would say like, that's the first one. The second is you got to be all in. So a lot of entrepreneurs, we're all like kind of like consulting in the beginning, or we have a full-time job and we need to like, you know, keep cash flow going in order for you to start the business. And I think that works for some time, but you got to be all in. You got to be focused. And I also think one of the things that is key to success is showing your team or showing your initial hires that you're all in. I think if you are distracted with side gigs or you don't show up on Zooms correctly on video, or you just don't bring the presence that you're passionate all in, like your team won't rally behind you in the same way. You set the culture at early stages. So I think those are like the two things I like to talk about a lot. The third is like, I would just say, you just got to be persistent. And in reality, anyone's going to believe you. I know it sounds silly, but like, if you are passionate enough and your product like tastes good or just makes sense, you will convince not only customers, you will also convince investors, you will get people to rally behind you, and it will give you more fuel and energy and confidence to making things happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm with you on showing your hires that you're all in. I mean, if you're not, how do you expect the people you hire to be? You know, it's like you have to you always have to set an example.
No, totally. And I think, again, you set the culture. So if you're like really focused and organized, then your team, we're just a bunch of humans, right? Like your team's going to like be organized because they know that their boss who pays you or is like looking over your work likes organization or hitting deadlines. And that's what they do. And I think, you know, how you show up every day is really important. And, you know, I just did a LinkedIn post on doing demos. And I still do demos, and I do it because I want to connect with my customers and I want to like learn from them. And I'd say like, honestly, like 60% of the packaging updates we've done design wise in terms of communication and design is through me just doing demos, because I'm learning so much from customers and how it sits on shelves. But, you know, it's difficult to do as a CEO is like to go spend a few hours doing that. But the reason why I also do it is because I think it sets an example that like, if you're doing it, the team can do it. And if you're passionate about it, the team gets passionate about it and they see the value in it.
Absolutely. And so what's next for Plant People?
Yeah. So Plant People, I think honestly, after going through the 2.5 years, 2 years of COVID of just like trying to get the business back on track, we are definitely on track. And I think honestly, we are just going to do more of the same. We are going to grow without external funding this year profitably, 30% year over year. And that's a conservative number. All of our channels are firing off and just really grateful for that. We do have some new products in the pipeline, and we're firm believers on the future. If you want to talk about like sort of just like bigger vision, we think customers and just people in general want to eat their health. So moving away from traditional capsules and powders and move towards sort of like functional foods. And I'm really excited for what's in the future. We have some really exciting new products that are related to like our current product set of what's performing, but also just future state.
It's awesome. Well, I'm excited to see the continued progress, and congrats on all of your success, minus the, you know, COVID hiccup that everybody experienced. But thank you so much for being on the show, Hudson, and sharing your story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Really appreciate the time.
thank you so much for listening to the Stairway to CEO podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Lee Green. And if you have any burning business questions, please feel free to reach us at www.stairwaytoceo.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to the show, tell your friends, leave us a review, and follow us on Instagram at Stairway to CEO. Until next time, guys, keep on climbing.